about concentric circles. That there's a little circle, then a bigger circle, then a bigger circle, and a bigger circle, and so on, he said. When a body is found, ladies and gentlemen, the immediate world is a suspect. Anybody could have committed the crime. But you can begin narrowing down your suspects, ladies and gentlemen, and I want to do that with you right now. Allgood did just that, winnowing down the field of possible killers from everyone in the universe to the four who were near or with Christine Jackson on the night of her death, her mom, Kennedy Brewer, LaShawn Williams, and Duane Graham. Four. No more. Four, Allgood implored. From there, he drew a smaller circle, the number of people locked in the house with Jackson that night. With Gloria Jackson's narrative-changing testimony, that number fell to just one, Kennedy Brewer. On Friday, March 24th, 1995, at a few minutes after 4 in the afternoon, the jurors in Brewer's case retired to deliberate. At a quarter to 6 on the same day, almost exactly an hour and a half after they began, the jury returned with a verdict. They found Kennedy Brewer guilty. They would wait until morning to decide if he would live. As in all death penalty cases, to get a death sentence, Allgood needed to convince the jury that there were aggravating circumstances. Allgood first attempted to prove that Christine Jackson had been sexually battered. He then introduced evidence, Haynes' autopsy testimony, to show that the murder was especially heinous, atrocious, and cruel. As in the Brooks trial, neither factor really needed to be proven. The crime itself provided ample evidence. Allgood didn't even bother with much of an opening statement. Also, as with the Brooks case, the defense's task now was to provide evidence of mitigating factors. Mitigation is a critical part of capital defense that's often overlooked in media and pop culture depictions of death penalty cases. The objective is to get the jury to empathize with the defendant, to show that his life is worth saving. It's so important that American Bar Association guidelines call for the appointment of two trial attorneys in death penalty cases, at least one of whom should be proficient in the sentencing phase. Since the early 2000s, the U.S. Supreme Court has consistently found that a thorough mitigation defense is guaranteed by the Eighth Amendment. But it wasn't always that way. Overworked attorneys in indigent cases often failed to introduce any mitigation at all, or saw it as little more than an opportunity to litigate the defendant's character, not to build empathy. It wasn't until the series of decisions in the 2000s cases that the U.S. Supreme Court laid out in more detail what was required for proper mitigation. Brewer's attorney's efforts at mitigation weren't necessarily worse than others in Mississippi at the time, but they were further complicated by the fact that Brewer had maintained his innocence. The defense first called Brewer's mother, Annie, as a witness. She begged the jury to spare her son's life. "Please, please, sir, and please, ma'am, don't put the death penalty on Kenny," she begged. "Please, I'm asking, please, don't, please." When she was done, Forrest Allgood rose and asked Annie Brewer whether there had been any 3-year-old girls sexually assaulted, killed, and dumped in creeks in Noxubee County since her son had been locked up. She had to agree that there hadn't. Of course, there was good reason for that. By then, Justin Albert Johnson had already pleaded guilty to the sexual assault of Verlinda Monroe in her trailer in Crawford. In fact, his plea came less than 3 weeks after Christine Jackson's murder. Annie Brewer had no way of knowing that, but local law enforcement should have. So Allgood was right. There hadn't been any child murders in the area since Kennedy Brewer had been arrested. And he was right that this was because Jackson's killer was behind bars. It just wasn't Brewer. The defense also called Brewer himself to testify. Given that the jury had found Brewer guilty of the rape and murder of a toddler only hours before, it's hard to fathom how Brewer's attorneys thought this would help. They asked him some rote questions about his background, as well as a few questions that made him somewhat sympathetic, such as how he dropped out of school after his father's death to help support his family. They then made another critical mistake. "Kennedy, you understand that the jury has to make a decision on sentencing in this case, is that right?"
"Yes, sir," Brewer answered.
"Are you asking the jury to be merciful within the law?"
"Yes, sir," he answered.
Again, Brewer had just been found guilty of the brutal rape of a toddler. He could maintain his innocence and hope jurors were willing to act on any lingering doubts, but given how quickly they had convicted him, it seems clear that within the jury box, doubt was in short supply. To ask mercy of the same people who just sat in judgment of you is a risky strategy. A defendant would need to demonstrate convincing contrition, and real remorse would require admitting to what he had done. But Brewer was innocent. Having him ask for mercy when he couldn't show contrition couldn't have set well with the jury. Allgood made the most of the defense's mistake. In his closing argument, he responded to Brewer's lawyer's request for a life sentence by mentioning the possibility that Brewer could escape. "I don't think that any one of you would want to pick up the paper someday and read where this man had done something else to somebody else, because in a moment of weakness, you did that which you were urged to do." Then, in his signature, formalized, folksy patois, Allgood implored the jury to return a death sentence by declaiming, "If we as a society cannot protect our children, if we as a society will not protect our children, then we will not long exist." For the main portion of his rebuttal, Allgood invoked the Bible. Quoting from or alluding specifically to the Bible, or any authoritative source outside of the evidence or jury instructions, is fraught with problems. Some courts will reverse convictions in almost every instance. Others issue reminders or chastise lawyers who try. Jurors' decisions are supposed to be based only on the evidence presented at trial and the jury instructions that guide their deliberations. Attorneys may cite the Bible to illustrate a point or to use as a metaphor, but they're generally prohibited from invoking it as an authority jurors should consult or use for guidance when deliberating. Allgood often invoked the Bible, and his closing argument in Kennedy Brewer's sentencing trial was a full-blown sermon. Allgood told the jury that he had always wondered about Pharaoh, the cruel ruler of Egypt who had enslaved the Israelites. How, Allgood asked, could God have created someone so cruel, but then at the same time have held that person accountable for his actions? Allgood explained, "One day I was reading along in Romans, and I think it's chapter 7, I can't be sure, but Paul says this, 'What if God, wanting to make his power known to the nations, made for himself vessels of wrath fit only for destruction?'" Vessels of wrath fit only for destruction. Ladies and gentlemen, I tell you that there are those among us, they look like us, they talk like us, they on the outside seem like us, but they aren't like us. They are indeed those vessels of wrath fit only for destruction. The day of Kennedy Brewer's sentencing dawned bright and fair in East Central Mississippi. By noon, the temperature outside edged toward 70 degrees. Brewer sat locked in a cramped jail cell on the second floor of the Noxubee County Courthouse. Dressed in an ill-fitting suit, he sat and tried to avoid contemplating his fate. But there was really no escaping what had just befallen him. He had been arrested for something he hadn't done. He then spent 4 years behind bars waiting for the trial he thought would finally set him free. Instead, just hours earlier, a jury convicted him of capital murder for the rape and murder of a 3-year-old girl. To make matters worse, whatever his shortcomings as a young father, Brewer had come to care a great deal for Christine Jackson. He thought of the girl as his own. Now she was gone, snatched from her home on his watch,
then brutally violated and killed. He wanted to be sad about that. He wanted to deal with his guilt for not waking up to protect her. He wanted to mourn. But at the moment, there was no room in his head for grief. Just down the hall from his cell, 12 jurors were deciding if he would live or die. Just before 2 p.m., there was a knock from the door leading to the jury room. The clerk walked to the door, cracked it slightly, and received a folded piece of paper. She read it silently, and then looked up. The jury had reached a unanimous decision. The sheriff's deputies ushered Brewer from his cell back to the seat beside his lawyers. The judge returned to the bench, and the clerk opened the rear door. The jurors filed in. The foreperson handed the verdict to the deputy clerk so that it could be read into the record. We, the jury, find that the defendant should suffer the penalty of death. As the clerk's voice faded, the judge ordered Brewer to enter the well of the courtroom. He obeyed. Bracketed by deputies, he slowly stepped forward. The judge began. Mr. Brewer, the jury of citizens of Lowndes County, Mississippi, has found you guilty of the crime of capital murder. The jury has returned that verdict in open court. That verdict was that you should suffer death. Do you have anything you desire to say to the court before sentence is imposed? No, Brewer responded softly. I am by law required at this time to set a date for your execution. I hereby direct that the sheriff immediately take custody of your body and immediately transport you to the maximum security unit of the Mississippi Department of Corrections at Parchman, Mississippi. You are to there remain in custody until May the 12th of 1995, at which time you will be removed to a place where you shall suffer death by lethal injection, the judge said. May God have mercy on your soul. Between 1976 and 2001, Mississippi executed just 4 people. That statistic may seem surprising. Alabama executed 23 over the same period. Texas executed 166 in the 1990s alone. In fact, in the 13 years between June 1989 and July 2002, Mississippi didn't execute anyone at all. It wasn't for lack of trying. In fact, the problem is that the state was trying a bit too hard. In 1980, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Godfrey v. Georgia that Georgia's death penalty instructions to jurors were unconstitutionally vague. As written, the instruction required jurors to return a verdict of death if they found a crime to be outrageously or wantonly vile, horrible, or inhuman. At the time, Mississippi's death penalty instructions included the phrase, especially heinous, atrocious, or cruel. Despite the similarly vague language, Mississippi stuck with its law, on the assumption that the inclusion of the word especially made its instructions less vague and thus constitutionally compliant. 8 years later, the U.S. Supreme Court held in Maynard v. Cartwright that Oklahoma's instructions, which were identical to Mississippi's, right down to the word especially, were also unconstitutionally vague. That finally moved the Mississippi legislature to change its jury instructions in capital cases. But state lawmakers and judges assumed that the decision only applied to cases going forward, not retroactively. It wasn't until the 1992 case Stringer v. Black that the U.S. Supreme Court formally rebuked the state. That would take a while, and it's why Mississippi had no choice but to take a long break from its industrious history of executing people. Another reason for the 13-year lack of executions was the work of Justice James Robertson. Robertson was cautious and skeptical when it came to death penalty cases, and he had a knack for bringing other justices along with him. Under Robertson's leadership, the court overturned a number of capital convictions deemed too faulty for the finality of the gas chamber. But the early 1990s also brought the aforementioned national surge in violent crime, and with it a surge in get-tough-on-crime rhetoric. In 1992, Robertson was voted off the court, defeated by a law and order candidate who ran a nasty campaign portraying Robertson as a friend to criminals. One other big reason Mississippi's executions slowed to a halt: the state consistently refused to fund legal counsel for indigent defendants during their appeals. This was part of the law and order crowd's common and most cynical complaint. Hardened criminals were routinely getting off on technicalities. Such outcomes were outrageous enough on their own, the argument went. It seemed downright insulting that taxpayers should have to foot the bill for such claims. The reality was that capital defendants weren't getting any legal representation after their first appeal. When their cases would then finally get to federal court, either by their own doing, with the help of a jailhouse lawyer, or through a pro bono attorney, federal appeals courts would find that their legal representation had been unconstitutionally defective. By refusing to fund an adequate public defender system, then, state lawmakers were contributing to the very drawn-out appeals process they were so fond of criticizing. In 1994, the Mississippi legislature responded to the soaring crime rate with a raucous debate over a bill intended to address prison overcrowding, but that quickly devolved into an orgy of punitiveness. There was talk of restoring fear to prisons, the New York Times reported of the debate in Jackson, of caning, of making prisoners smell like a prisoner, of burning and frying, of returning executions to the county seat. Governor Kirk Fordyce implored lawmakers to make Mississippi the capital of capital punishment. By the time it was over, the legislature had banned TVs, radios, CD players, and weightlifting equipment from state prisons. They required inmates to wear striped uniforms with the word convict printed across the back. Said one state representative, "When you see one of these boogers loose, you'll say, 'I didn't know we had zebras in Mississippi.'" That summer, Governor Kirk Fordyce took some time off to go on a big-game hunting safari in Africa. In his absence, Lieutenant Governor Eddie Briggs filled in as acting governor. Briggs, generally considered to be more moderate than Fordyce, took the opportunity to convene a special session of the legislature solely for the purpose of passing laws to expand and expedite the death penalty. Among the bills under consideration, empowering elected judges, not juries, to impose the death penalty, expanding the doctrine of harmless error so fewer convictions could be overturned on technicalities, and adding a slate of new crimes to those already punishable by death. In the end, most of the measures never made it into law, but that was mostly due to partisan squabbling over who would get credit for them. When it came to executing more people more often in Mississippi, there was widespread bipartisan support. By 1997, death penalty fervor even had many clamoring for the execution of a 14-year-old girl who had been accused of killing her newborn daughter. As most in the state saw it, the problem wasn't that Mississippi didn't have adequate protections for the innocent. It was that the protections that did exist were hindering the electorate's bloodlust. In 1994, in between the Brooks and Brewer verdicts, the Enterprise Journal in Macomb, Mississippi editorialized, "As an effective deterrent to crime, the death penalty should be swift and certain. Unfortunately, the carrying out of the death sentence in America has been anything but that. Serious wrongdoers are condemned to die, and they often wait 5, 10, 12 years or more for the penalty to be carried out." In 1995, Fordyce announced in his State of the State address that he wanted all death row inmates executed within 3 years of their conviction. The press endorsed Fordyce's call to action. Despite the Clarion Ledger's consistent and admirable demands to hire and support a state medical examiner, the paper also led the charge for speeding up executions. "For the death penalty to be an effective deterrent, it must be carried out quickly," the paper editorialized in October 1995, just a few months after Kennedy Brewer was sentenced to death. "No one wants an innocent person to be executed, but appeal procedures could be changed to shorten the process." Fordyce continued to demand speedier, more frequent state-sponsored killing. In his 1996 State of the State address, he demanded a one-year limit on death penalty appeals and asked the legislature to add high-volume drug dealing to the list of crimes punishable by death. In 1997, he held a news conference in which he was flanked by the widows of two men who had recently been murdered, one of them a former assistant attorney general. Fordyce again lamented the state's slow progress with executions, this time with especially dehumanizing language. States like Texas and Arkansas, Fordyce complained, are continually working down their inventory on death row, and ours continues to grow. Again, the state's press dutifully followed along. The Clarion Ledger ran another supportive editorial in February 1998 that closed with this rhetorical flourish. There are 58 names on the death row roster. Let's let the sword of justice do its work. At the time that editorial ran, there were 8 men in Mississippi's prisons who had been convicted of murder, but would later be exonerated. In fact, there may not have been a more execution-obsessed op-ed page in America at the time than the Clarion Ledger's. Between 1994 and 1998 alone, Mississippi's largest newspaper ran 38 unsigned editorials in support of the death penalty, calls to speed it up, expand it, or apply it in a particular case. When the Mississippi Supreme Court finally allowed DNA testing for Kennedy Brewer in July 2001, the paper published a staff editorial supporting Brewer's right to have the DNA tested, but added, "The existence of DNA does not refute the need for the death penalty." By the early 1990s, advances in DNA technology allowed for testing that could exclude defendants as the source of biological material found at a crime scene. The technology enabling DNA scientists to match biological evidence came along later. By 2001, DNA testing had cleared 11 people who had been wrongly convicted and sentenced to death. In other words, the existence of DNA showed that the system could get it wrong, and far more often than most of the public believed. The death penalty didn't cause the system's flaws, but it did cement those flaws with an ultimate and irreversible punishment. By 2001, Kennedy Brewer had been on death row for 6.5 years. At one point, he had been scheduled for execution. If the death penalty had been more swift and certain, as the Clarion Ledger, Kirk Fordyce, and a good chunk of Mississippi's politicians and prosecutors had advocated throughout the 1990s, Kennedy Brewer would be dead. If the death penalty across the country had been swifter and more certain, the 11 men cleared by DNA testing across the country by 2001 would be dead too. Perhaps the most perverse thing about Mississippi's death penalty debate in the 1990s is that it was only by the grace of petty politics and fragile egos that the state never went on the execution bins that everyone seemed to want. Kirk Fordyce's goal to expedite executions and make Mississippi the capital of capital punishment was supported by the leaders of both major political parties, prosecutors, most of the judiciary, the state's largest newspapers, and a healthy majority of Mississippians. Certainly some of Fordyce's proposals wouldn't have passed constitutional muster once they were inevitably challenged in federal court. But the main reason most of Fordyce's killing agenda was never enacted is that the other power players in Mississippi politics at the time, from Lieutenant Governor Briggs to Attorney General Mike Moore to the leaders in the state legislature, either didn't want to give Fordyce a political victory or wanted all the tough-on-crime credit for themselves. You could make a strong argument that Kirk Fordyce's likability problems saved Kennedy Brewer's life. Without oversight from the state medical examiner's office, Stephen Hain was flourishing. By the late 1990s, his annual autopsy totals topped 1,500, which meant he was grossing $750,000 per year from county autopsy fees alone. But Hain was also looking to do more private autopsies, where he often charged $1,500 or more per procedure, plus significantly more per hour for testimony and trial preparation than he got from the state. Around 1995, Hain joined Investigative Research Incorporated, IR, to help facilitate his work in private cases. Initially, IR was a small operation whose main clients were insurance companies that hired it to conduct arson investigations. After bringing Hain aboard, IR expanded to take on investigations for life insurance companies, plus provide expert testimony in civil litigation, often related to medical malpractice and wrongful deaths. Meanwhile, 2 years after Emily Ward left, Mississippi still didn't have a state medical examiner. The coroners and prosecutors who had chased Ward out were fine with that. They both declared victory and pushed to ensure that no one like her occupied the office again. "All I can say is that Hinds County hasn't missed a beat without a state medical examiner," Coroner Robert Martin told the Clarion Ledger. Jimmy Roberts agreed. "It seems to me things run smoother when we don't have one." Washington County Coroner George Hampton told the paper that when he had a question about the job, he just asked Stephen Hain. "Anytime I have a question, I always call him, and he is able to respond whenever I need him." Carl Oliver, the president of the Coroner's Association, agreed. "The system is working absolutely fine," he said. Michael West had done such a convincing job with his public advocacy that his hometown paper, the Hattiesburg American, recommended abolishing the state medical examiner entirely. A staff editorial opined, "A competent coroner and pathologist working at the local level are more than qualified to conduct death investigations and render accurate opinions. Mississippi can do without a state medical examiner. As far as we're concerned, pardon the pun, this is a dead issue." For good measure, the editorial also quoted West, "In my 16 years in this field, I've never seen one instance where a state medical examiner was needed. Not one." For their part, state officials weren't going out of their way to find Ward's replacement. The position was advertised with a salary of $69,000, which would have made whoever took the job the lowest-paid state medical examiner in the country. One needn't be a conspiracy theorist to wonder if the Mississippi offer wasn't intended to prevent qualified candidates from applying. It seems clear that most powerful people in the state's criminal justice system wanted the office to remain vacant. Legislators didn't feel particularly obligated to offer more because no one who had their ear was really complaining. From the legislature's point of view, the state was saving money by not funding the salary and benefits of a state medical examiner and a full office of support staff. From the county's perspective, the $500 autopsy fee remained the same whether the funds went to the state medical examiner's office or to Stephen Hain's bank account. The former might give prosecutors a more professional autopsy, but the latter often guaranteed a conviction. The coroners were happy, police and prosecutors were happy. People charged with serious crimes were going to prison. Yet in reality, even setting aside the problems with Hain's massive workload, the state was still losing a lot of money. As the legislature was partially funding the medical examiner's office, it was also providing funding for staff and upkeep for the modern state morgue that had been built especially to facilitate autopsies. It went largely unused. Mississippi taxpayers were paying twice for the same government function, once to build and maintain a fancy new state morgue and crime lab, and then again for Hain's after-hours assembly line autopsies at a private morgue. But because the fees were paid by the individual counties, the wasted money wasn't apparent to public officials, much less to taxpayers. The following year, the Clarion Ledger published another article about the vacant state medical examiner position. This time it was Michael West who assured Mississippians that he and Steve Hain had it all under control. Perhaps the state needed a functionary in the state medical examiner's office to handle paperwork, West argued, but nothing more. "We need someone who can help the police and organize the coroners," he said. "What we don't need is a medical pathologist who wants to argue with other pathologists about cause of death, which has happened in the past." That's exactly what the state needed. A few years after Hain joined investigative research, he consulted on two lawsuits against a company called Graco Children's Products. The lawsuits alleged that the company's defective infant rockers had caused two babies to suffocate. Hain had done the original autopsies on the children, and in both cases originally said they had died of sudden infant death syndrome, SIDS, a conclusion a medical examiner makes only after excluding nearly everything else. After he was contacted by the attorneys for the parents bringing the lawsuits, he changed his diagnosis to death by positional asphyxiation, which he said was caused by a defect in the rocker. The children's bodies had by then been buried. There is no indication that they were ever exhumed and re-examined. In a deposition for the case, Hain claimed that at the time he did the original autopsies, deaths by positional asphyxiation were commonly misdiagnosed as SIDS. Coincidentally, he said that just 4 months prior to the deposition, just at about the time the attorneys for the plaintiffs in the case approached him, positional asphyxiation had come to the forefront of medical knowledge. Forensic specialists say Hain's explanation doesn't add up. "It would be very difficult to change from SIDS to asphyxiation," said James Starrs, a professor at George Washington University and author of several forensic textbooks, in a 2007 interview. "The latter is a more specific diagnosis, one that would require the presences of symptoms Hain should have noticed during the original autopsies." That he didn't certainly raises questions about whether he either badly botched the autopsies or concocted the diagnosis for the lawsuit. Investigative Research then invoiced the plaintiff's attorneys for Hain's services. His price, $37,000. John Stossel's ABC News report featuring Michael West finally aired in 1997. The segment was part of an hour-long special about junk science. Stossel delved into West's analysis and reported that West had been sending a brochure to police departments in Mississippi and Louisiana to advertise his services. In the brochure, West offered to come and explain his methods to any police agency willing to pay him $900, which is to say that for $900 he'd come and tell police departments why they should hire him in future cases. According to Stossel, West's brochure promised that he can turn cases that were once unsolved into police convictions. The segment also included footage in which West boldly declared, "All talents, all gifts that I possess are directed straight from God." By 1998, West had been criticized in the American Bar Association Journal, the National Law Journal, ABC News, and the New Orleans Times-Picayune. He had been forced to resign from the American Academy of Forensic Sciences and the International Association for Identification, and had been suspended from the ABFO. His testimony had been thrown out in three separate murder cases, and he had caused the wrong man to be arrested and jailed for a year in a murder case in Humphreys County, after which the real killer went on to kill again. It's also the year that the Mississippi Supreme Court officially gave Michael West its endorsement. The endorsement came by way of Kennedy Brewer's appeal, which the justices were hearing for the first time. In dismissing Brewer's claims about West, the court laid out a litany of excuses and explanations for West's behavior and mistakes. The majority explained away the rising chorus of critics as mere differences of opinion between professionals. The opinion claimed that the record evidence shows that Dr. West possessed the knowledge, skill, experience, training, and education necessary to qualify as an expert in forensic odontology. The court ruled that the problems he encountered, a self-serving, antiseptic description of West's history, went to the weight and credibility to be assigned his testimony by the jury, not his qualifications. The court then rejected all of Brewer's other claims and upheld his conviction. It ordered his execution to be scheduled within 60 days of the dispensation of his case. There was no dissent. The next year, the court rejected Levon Brooks's appeal, too. The state's brief in Brooks's case is a study in prosecutorial tunnel vision. It's clear from the brief that its author, who worked in the Attorney General's office, made little effort to confirm the veracity of the damning statements Allgood made at Brooks's trial. The meandering, contradictory, often fantastical answers Ashley Smith gave over the course of her two police interviews and trial testimony? Here's how the state characterized them. Ashley's identification of Brooks was immediate and unwavering through the first interview, the photo lineup, and the trial itself. This is simply false. It's either a lie or a false statement arising from stunning inattention to the facts. It is, of course, the job of the Attorney General's staff to defend convictions, but the office is also supposed to serve the interests of justice. Here, the state's brief merely parroted Allgood's closing argument. It made no effort to look back to verify if it was actually true. The brief then addressed the court's denial of Kennedy Brewer's appeal the year before. Its characterization of that decision is chilling. Brewer versus State was a case from the same trial court as the case at bar, arising from the murder of another 3-year-old in the same small town as in the present case. The facts of the two cases are almost unbelievably similar. Brewer was convicted of murder, and an important part of the state's evidence was a bite mark comparison of Brewer's teeth with the marks left on the child's body. The court found this evidence to be sufficient for conviction. Brewer, unlike the present case, resulted in a death penalty for the defendant. If this evidence passed the heightened scrutiny of death penalty cases, there is no reason why it should be held inadmissible in the present case. It turns out that when properly motivated, state officials were able to see the remarkable similarities between these two cases after all. They just couldn't take the next step, asking if the same man committed both crimes. That would require considering the possibility that the state got it wrong. The court voted 8-1 to uphold the conviction. With respect to the bite mark evidence, the majority first found that because Brooks didn't object to Michael West's credentials at trial, he was procedurally barred from raising them in his appeal. But the court also went a lot further than it needed to. It ruled that bite mark analysis was now universally admissible in Mississippi courts, a form of evidence just as reliable as fingerprints or DNA. When the Clarion Ledger reached out to Michael West for his reaction, West reported that he was elated. "It's taken us quite a while to get to reach this point," he said. "For many years I've had to endure the assaults of defense attorneys on the validity of bite marks." The only dissent came from Justice Charles McRae, at the time the court's most astute justice on these issues. McRae made all of the right arguments, that bite mark analysis in general was entirely subjective, had no scientific support for its underlying premises, and lacked any uniform criteria or methodology for determining a match. He also included a pretty thorough rundown of West's long and growing list of transgressions. Unfortunately, just about anything McRae did on the court at that time was overshadowed by a recent drunk driving arrest. A state Supreme Court justice had just written the most critical and accurate assessment of West by any Mississippi judge to date, but few would hear him. Chapter 12. Prayers for Relief. Whatever problems our system has, it cannot be as bad as all that. Judge J. Harvey Wilkinson III, Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. By 2000, Michael West had lost his position as Forest County Coroner, and Hayne hired him as an assistant. And though at least some prosecutors began steering clear of West, others, like Forrest Allgood, continued to use him. In fact, as the public criticism of West mounted, Allgood's defense of the dentist became strident and unmoored from reality. During the second trial of Eddie Lee Howard, the man convicted of raping and killing Georgia Kemp and then setting her house on fire, the defense had brought up all of the usual allegations against West. Perhaps Allgood sensed that momentum was building against his star witness, and he was growing restless. Perhaps he feared how that would reflect on his own career. Whatever his motivation, he delivered a closing argument that was the most embarrassing defense of either Hayne or West ever uttered by a Mississippi public official. By the time he was finished, Allgood had essentially argued that children would one day be reading about West in their history books. Ladies and gentlemen, I expect that much of what you hear when I sit down will be an attack, he began, anticipating what Howard's attorneys would say in their own closing arguments. An attack primarily on one man and one thing, Dr. Michael West. Allgood conceded that West could be brash and evasive, and that he possessed an ego that probably wouldn't fit into the courtroom, a line that likely elicited some chuckles. But then came the exaltations. West, Allgood said, was also guilty of being a pioneer, a visionary, somebody that has found something new and pushed it to the limits, something that is now accepted throughout his profession as the standard. The first few items in that list were arguably true, though not in the way Allgood intended. The last line was false. Bite mark analysis was not accepted within or endorsed by the scientific community at large, and even West's fellow bite mark analysts had begun to distance themselves from him. Allgood went on. Whether we like to think so or not, the progress of mankind has been carried forward on the backs of people like Michael West, he rhapsodized. You don't have to look far if you'll look into history. The church threatened to burn Copernicus because he dared to say that the planets didn't revolve around the earth. Allgood then paused. So it was with Michael West. Michael West was no longer merely a credible expert witness. He was an intellect for the ages. He wasn't just a skilled bite mark analyst. He was a martyr, a paladin for truth who had been persecuted for his dogged pursuit of knowledge. Never mind that in his grandiloquence, Allgood conflated Copernicus with Galileo. As for West's suspensions and resignations, Allgood assured the jury they hadn't slowed him up one bit. He still testifies as an expert. He still lectures on bite marks. He still lectures on ALI, alternate light imaging. And yes, he's a leader in his field. Allgood wasn't wrong here. West did still testify. That was exactly the problem. Not finished, Allgood went on to call West cutting-edge, a man who wears many hats, and he weirdly praised West's expertise in ergonomics. Finally, Allgood told the jury that West is an individual who is very interested in forensic sciences and has plunged headlong into them with the enthusiasm of a 3-year-old child. The jury then convicted Eddie Lee Howard a second time. And for a second time, a jury sentenced him to die. The Supreme Court's Daubert decisions of the early 1990s didn't do much to keep bad science out of the courtroom. In fact, they may have made things worse. One effect of the decisions was to create a market for certifying organizations to confer expert status on would-be forensic witnesses. As a result, forensics today is awash in a sea of acronyms. Some of these groups are legitimate, but many are pay-to-play certification mills. The net effect is that for a fee, just about anyone who wants to can get accredited in a given field of forensics by finding a group willing to sell them a slip of paper to frame and hang on a wall. The courts have essentially ceded responsibility for sorting the sea of acronyms to attorneys. Stephen Hain is a good example. The organization Hain most often says has certified him is the American Board of Forensic Pathology. That name sounds suspiciously similar to the American Board of Pathology, a widely recognized certifying organization, and with good reason. Whereas a medical examiner certified by the ABP would say on the witness stand, "I'm certified in forensic pathology by the American Board of Pathology," Hain would say, "I'm certified by the American Board of Forensic Pathology." The two claims sound virtually the same, but there's a world of difference between them. When asked in 2008 whether someone should testify in court to being board certified without having passed the ABP test, Joseph Prahlo, the then president of the National Association of Medical Examiners, replied, "When you say you're certified, It means the American Board of Pathology. When told that Hain routinely says he's board-certified in forensic pathology, despite not passing the exam, Prahlo replied, "That is very disturbing to me. There's definitely a problem with that." As a result, in the vast majority of cases in which Hain invoked the organization, judges, jurors, and even opposing attorneys could be confused and not realize that the American Board of Forensic Pathology is an entirely different organization from the American Board of Pathology. Or, to be more accurate, it was an entirely different organization. The group hasn't existed since 1996. When it did exist, it was part of a larger Las Vegas-based organization called the American Academy of Neurological and Orthopedic Surgery, AANOS. For years, AANOS issued certifications in dozens of medical fields. If it seems odd that a group of neurological and orthopedic surgeons would be certifying doctors in forensic pathology, an entirely different field, it is. A 1994 profile of the group in the journal Medical Economics reported that AANOS offered certifications in more than 50 medical specialties, including such exotic fields as bionic rehabilitative psychology, ringside medicine and surgery, percutaneous discectomy, and radiofrequency surgery. The group was founded by Michael Rask, a surgeon, an eccentric, and apparently a devoted fan of Frank Sinatra. He changed his name to Bartholomew Sinatra shortly before he died. Hain also claimed certification by another organization with an even odder history. The august-sounding American College of Forensic Examiners Institute, ACFEI, was founded by Robert Louis O'Block, a criminal justice professor who, according to a 2000 ABA Journal article, had been terminated from Appalachian State University in 1991 for plagiarism. In the same article, O'Block insisted that his termination was retaliation for whistleblowing. At his subsequent teaching gig, O'Block developed an interest in the field of handwriting analysis. But when he applied for membership with an existing organization of forensic handwriting experts, they rejected him. So he decided to form his own credentialing organization for handwriting and put himself in charge. In 1992, he founded the American Board of Forensic Handwriting Analysts. Fraud Magazine reported in 2012 that as O'Block expanded his group to other disciplines, he also hired his first national training director for the organization, a high school graduate with no college experience who claimed he could enlarge women's breasts through hypnosis. The breast-enlarging hypnotist would later resign as a result of his own doubts about O'Block's credibility. And yet somehow O'Block continued to collect new members to his organization. In 1995, he renamed the organization the American College of Forensic Examiners. He added the word institute after objections from a group already using the ACFE acronym. He formed a board of directors consisting of himself, his wife, and his two minor children. He paid himself a salary just over $50,000 per year and started a hotline to hook his members up with lawyers in need of expert witnesses, 1-800-4-A-EXPERT. The ABA Journal reported that by the year 2000, the ACFEI offered boards in 11 specialties and claimed over 13,000 members and 17,000 diplomates. A member could be a diplomate in more than one field. Revenues for the group cleared $2 million, and O'Block's salary jumped to $200,000 per year. Today, the ACFEI claims to be the largest forensic certification organization in the country. It may well be. It boasts celebrity spokespersons from the forensics world, like famed medical examiner Cyril Wecht and forensic analyst Henry Lee. Hain, like many other ACFEI diplomates, was grandfathered in for his certification. He had to provide only a resume and pay a $350 fee. The Wall Street Journal reported in 1999 that ACFEI candidates who weren't grandfathered have to score 75% or higher on an ethics test. But the test was largely symbolic. It included questions like, is it ever okay to misrepresent yourself? And is it ever okay to stretch the truth? Failing applicants could retake the test up to 3 times. Even the test requirement could also be waived entirely if a candidate's application accumulated 100 points. Points weren't determined by ACFEI, but by applicants themselves using the honor system. And even that could be waived. The ABA Journal interviewed a psychiatry professor at Washington University in St. Louis who received ACFEI certification without even trying. And a prison inmate named Seymour Schlager was able to obtain a certification by ACFEI's American Board of Forensic Medicine while serving time for attempted murder. In 2002, a woman was able to get certification by using the name of her cat. Despite awarding thousands of certifications, ACFEI hasn't always been forthcoming about whom it certifies. When asked over the years, the organization has said such information is confidential, seemingly an odd practice for an accrediting group. Despite ACFEI officials' protestations that the organization is not a certification mill, in 2012, a journalism graduate student named Leah Bartos was able to get certified as a forensic consultant, despite having no prior experience in forensics. According to Bartos, no one from ACFEI ever contacted any of her professional references. In the end, both ACFEI and AANOS allowed Hain to continue to claim to be board certified in forensic pathology without technically perjuring himself. Most of the time, no one in the courtroom knew enough to ask further questions. Of course, even properly credentialed experts can still give non-credible testimony, but proper credentials at least establish a baseline. They can define a minimal level of demonstrated competency in an expert witness. Nevertheless, that presumes judges, prosecutors, and defense attorneys will know which credentialing groups are legitimate and which aren't. Credentials are often appealing shortcuts, Michigan Circuit Court Judge Donald Shelton told Bartos in her 2012 ProPublica report. Fancy titles can have a disproportionate effect on juries. Jurors have no way of knowing that this certifying body, whether it's this one or any other one, exacts scientific standards or is just a diploma mill. Ideally, the courts would help jurors sort all of this out. There just hasn't been much interest. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, Mississippi saw an increase in convictions based on shaken baby syndrome, SBS, a controversial diagnosis that holds that if a trio of specific symptoms are found in a dead child, the death could only have been caused by violent shaking, even if there is no corresponding impact to the head. It's a convenient diagnosis in that it provides prosecutors with a method of homicide, shaking, a likely suspect, the last person alone with the child, and intent. Built into the diagnosis is the notion that babies only die this way after exceptionally violent shaking. But over the last decade or so, the diagnosis has come under increased scrutiny. Even the doctor who first came up with the theory has now expressed doubts about it. Recent research has shown that falls, blows to the head, and even some illnesses and genetic conditions can cause the same set of symptoms. It isn't that all SBS cases are wrongful convictions, of course. It's that the trio of symptoms themselves shouldn't be the sole basis of a conviction. A number of convictions have been overturned. Many more are under review. Defense attorneys interviewed for this book say there has long been a sentiment among some police and prosecutors in Mississippi that when it comes to babies who die unnatural deaths, there are no accidents. Someone killed the child, either willfully or through criminally negligent parenting. Babies don't die without someone being at fault. Therefore, somebody must be punished. Stephen Hain testified to SBS in several cases. The Clarion Ledger reported in 2014 that since 2000 there had been 11 such convictions in the state. Because these cases often end with a plea bargain before trial, most don't leave much of a public record. so it's hard to say exactly how many relied on a diagnosis from Hain. But given the percentage of the state's autopsies he was doing at the time, it seems likely that he was involved in many of them. In most SBS cases, prosecutors would first file murder charges, then later allow the defendant to plead down to a lesser charge like manslaughter. But there are two cases in which Hain's SBS diagnosis led not only to a murder conviction, but also a death sentence. The first is that of Devin Bennett, who in 2000 was accused of killing his infant son, Brandon. In an odd twist, Bennett's attorneys actually brought in Emily Ward to rebut Hain's testimony. Ward, then working for the state of Alabama, was reluctant to testify, given her history in Mississippi. She made her way to court only after an Alabama court ordered her to appear. After she was questioned by Bennett's attorney, the prosecutor aggressively cross-examined Ward about her fights with Hain, West, and the state's coroners and prosecutors. Ward's efforts to clean up the state had put her under attack all over again. Only this time, a man's life was at stake. The tactic apparently worked. The jury convicted Bennett and sentenced him to death. The Mississippi Supreme Court upheld the conviction. The court had no problem with prosecutors probing Ward's personal feelings about Dr. Hain and her forthrightness in the reasons for leaving her employment. "That case was like a lot of others where a baby died, and so someone had to pay for it," Ward said in a 2008 interview. "But I still think about it. I think it was a miscarriage of justice. I still think Devin is innocent." The SBS conviction of Jeffrey Havard demonstrates, as well as any other, how, without DNA testing, it can be nearly impossible to overturn convictions based on faulty forensic testimony. In many of these cases, the degree to which the courts went out of their way to avoid confronting the obvious problems with Hain and West isn't apparent until you really dig into the details. Only after reading the court opinions after successive challenges do you begin to see problems, such as how one opinion can directly contradict another but still reach the same outcome, the intellectually dishonest approach courts often take with unfavorable forensic evidence, and how, too often, defendants never really stand a chance at a fair hearing. Havard's case embodies all of these problems. The story begins on the evening of February 21, 2002, when Havard was watching Chloe, the six-month-old daughter of his girlfriend, Rebecca Britt. According to Havard, at some point Chloe had spit up on her clothes and bedding, so he gave the girl a bath. As he pulled her up out of the tub, she slipped from his grip and fell. As she fell, she struck her head on the toilet. Havard would say that the bump on Chloe's head didn't appear to be serious, so he dressed her in clean clothes and put her to bed. Not wanting to worry Rebecca, or perhaps not wanting to anger her, he said nothing about the incident when she returned. When she did get home, Rebecca checked on the baby, who seemed fine. She and Havard ate dinner and went about their evening. Later that night, Chloe stopped breathing. When Havard and Rebecca couldn't get her breathing again, they rushed her to a hospital. Chloe died shortly thereafter. When the emergency room doctors examined Chloe, they discovered that her anus was dilated. This isn't uncommon in infants shortly after death. It's also common in infants who are still alive but have lost brain function. Unfortunately, even trained medical staff sometimes mistake it for sexual abuse. Stephen Hain performed an autopsy the following evening. In his autopsy, Hain noted a 1-centimeter contusion on Chloe's rectum, which he documented in a photograph. But his autopsy report made no mention of any evidence of sexual assault. He also found symptoms he said were consistent with shaken baby syndrome. Unfortunately, Havard didn't admit that he dropped Chloe until a videotaped interview 2 days after her death. That meant his story had changed. That, the statements from the ER staff about possible sexual abuse, and Hain's SBS diagnosis were enough for local officials to arrest Havard and charge him with capital murder. The district attorney said he would seek the death penalty. Havard was indigent, so the court assigned him a public defender. His attorney asked the district court judge for funds to hire his own forensic pathologist. The judge turned him down, finding that there was no need for a separate pathologist when Dr. Hain was available.